it. I can't believe I asked for nail polish and I got it. That was amazing and beautiful. Thank you so much. So our last reader for the evening is Claire. I met Claire in a creative writing class in my senior year at Earlham College. And I found out that we actually led parallel lives just 20 miles or so from one another in Indianapolis. So much so, we even have the same arch nemesis. Another story, but at any rate. So like I said, yeah, she's from Indianapolis. Her lit moms are like me, and apparently, like Laura, Sylvia Plath, Audrey and Rich, and Audre Lorde. She writes poetry, and she does visual art in zines and mixed media art books. And she was raised by a series of black cats. Her second chapbook is in the planning stages under Cat Lady Lit, which would make it my first chapbook. But at any rate, Claire.
All right. I don't do well with microphones. Okay, so I have been panicking all day, but then I realized that I'm going home and none of you know me, so it doesn't matter if you like it or not. So let's just go.
All right, we'll like it.
All right. My first poem is Getting Clean, Staying Dirty. I want to freebase you, reduce you to your elements and inhale you off of tin foil. I want your smoke to burn all my membranes, a face on fire and full of you. That's how close we should be. But now, in my mind's eye, I see you put down a love letter. You put down a cigarette. You take my touch and my breath and crush them in a spoon and try to make me fit in the syringe, knowing I can't and knowing contaminants to these pure memories could kill you, make you dope sick mad and full of the leaving and all of the alone times. But the filter of distance works well. We will only ever be white trash happy, mutt dog types, holding no papers and possessing no parents and lying belly to the sun, fixed on a long, long chain, given free rein to one plot only, one crabgrass field. But I could be content sun basking in grass that's only half grown, baking all that needle need out of you and making love letters and distance into memories while I find a way to need you, not possess you, and to breathe you freely, not the jagged junky inhale. All I want to be is big gulp in one hand, a plastic bag of lingerie dangling off the other wrist, walking home from Walmart, walking home to you. Sorry. Selfie. Refusing to clean the wine-stained kitchen floor, refusing to drink the holy tequila, refusing to drink. Who are you of dirty floors and far-flung clothes, of tired limbs and of final forgiveness? Who are you of staring outwards through windows, of never leaving, of not wanting to stay? You are recognizable only in raspberry lips, and too early. Are you the mother with too many candles and too few ambitions? Are you the mother? Are you sacred here? This poem is called Not Now. It was a very rough poem to write, but I have it included, so I'm going to read it. This would have been my 9th month. I would have been heavy with it. All bloated ankles and aching bladder, I would have been ready to have this thing over with. I would have been almost finished before beginning. I am not afraid now, but I would have been. If not for what they did in January, my new start in the new year when they pried me open from the inside out and vacuumed out the problems while I twisted and squirmed and the nurse said, "You're only making this harder on yourself." I did not scream. I did not cry in the recovery room or at home on the couch, curled around the empty part, holding it, but only weeping the blood that poured for months, emptying me more and more. The story isn't theirs, the sweet nurse, or the scary nurse, or the exhausted, patienceless nurse, or the doctor with the tube, or the boy in the waiting room to whom I do not speak. This story may not be mine. So I'm from Indiana, as Jocelyn established, but when I was in high school, I dated a boy who was from Massachusetts, and there was a little bit of culture clash sometimes. On feeling oddly othered. One. I tell him, that lady on TV, the white trash grandma who's probably less than 40 and already frayed and broken, really just looks like she's been rode hard and put away wet. He immediately assumes he knows what that means. He's a smart guy, a scholar. He can pick up on what's not quite been said. It's like with horses, I explain. Now he gets it, kind of. He tries to think of anyone he knows who rides horses, and I point out the girls he knows are equestrians, not cowgirls, and never mind where I heard it, not having horses. It's just a phrase. Something that's said out here where women, like horses, are valued in their trainable youth. Two, I am telling a story. A friend from back home, her baby's daddy got put in prison, won't see his girls till they're teenagers, and it's because Joey killed someone, or they ended up dead on his couch. This is an incidental in my story. It's not the point, but he interrupts. You shouldn't really call her a friend, should you? As if we only met once, chatted briefly, acquaintances who shared one alarming and memorable anecdote. But I have known her longer than I have known him. And when we work together, it's fluid and seamless and silent. And I have watched her pregnancies and she has watched me hit my head against higher education. And he says to me, I mean, you know her, but she's not exactly a friend. Three, I tell him, that girl on TV, the 18-year-old who won't graduate or get a job or even pay attention, who reminds me just a little of my sister. The girl they make into a beauty queen? I say, that girl needs the military. That'll knock some sense into her, make her behave, and responsibly, and whether she wants it or not. He says simultaneously, that girl needs to be sent to boarding school. I guess he means for the same sort of reasons. To get similar results. He says, that's the difference between your people and mine. You send them to the army and we send them to school. This next poem is about a friend of mine who OD'd in a particularly tragic way. Not that an overdose is ever not a tragic way to go, but. Rock bottom. I'm having a dream where I'm in the bathroom cooking up ramen prison style there in the sink, steamy water hot enough to cook skin raw, hardly hot enough for rehydrating dinner, and it is dinner time, or later, but then this isn't the cinder block bathroom I started in, and I open the door to Jay's living room with the dark wood paneling on the walls, covered in baby pictures, all pigtails and little girls in pink, and Julie's there, passed out on the blue recliner, which is really in Jay's room. And she's not just passed out, she's dead. Julie is dead in life, in this dream, with her blonde curls rolling over her open eyes, but not her mouth, open like in life, like in sleep, or in a drunken plea for me to stop and shape up now while I can. Julie nodded off with the baby still on her lap. In life, in the dream, the baby is there and crying and turns to me because I am the only other living person. But it isn't Julie's little girl crying for me. It's my best friend's son crying for her because she's left him in life. And in the dream, I am left to explain to the child why the mother has gone, that 16 was too young, or how dope pulled too hard at the sleeve until distraction became destruction. Or is it better to just say, a better place? Next one is a recovery poem, which was written when I was not really in a good recovery position, but in a better place now. How the Other Half Lives. Someday I will write about how gloriously comfortable I am. My world smooth and soft, not about angle and cold and negative space. How there's a cushion around my tailbones and the lights don't have fuzzy halos. I will write that I've come to this place only by default, that there was nothing left. There was only being thin, and what was that anymore? Certainly not self-improvement, but not quite suicide. Not enough either way. The razor edge of living out a well-informed type of self-destruction. There was no point in living life well, of writing good papers and going to work every day with the hope of a better job in the far-off future when I knew I'd die by 25. But contradiction. The hatred of imperfection got me here in the first place, so failure simply cannot be the answer. As the therapist knows and the doctor with her specialty clinic on the other side of town knows too well, no one can decide for me, especially if that decision is made by default, especially if that decision is supposed to be a resigned sigh and not a hardened resolution. And the doctors, the psychiatrists, the therapist can also see, despite my thorough education, I know nothing intimate of recovery. I have only heard rumors and wanted of things. But I'll be able to say on the day I am complete that the darkness was only enough to tell me there was something greater to find. My real self was out there just beyond the fog. She is the self I know when I see in the mirror, not the double-take, second-glance self that I've been living with for so long, my unsure reflection with delayed reactions. My real and undiscovered self broke through. She surfaced after so long wearing a wide streak of confidence. My recovered self has mad swag and doesn't bicker with the bitch in her head about the value of eating her damn lunch and getting on with her damn day. She moves forward, doesn't turn back and fall into the endless empty and the uncountable pain. She doesn't tell her story because she doesn't need to remember, forget. Herself is enough. This one's called Frank. We went to the theater on an afternoon in early spring when it was still cold enough for me to wear my longest white fur over a Tiffany blue dress, new look silhouette in silk with both rhinestones and bows. I wore my hair up and my lips red, and you wore your nicer dress shoes. We saw Shakespeare, a comedy, and while I was in the bathroom, you took and hid my cigarettes. I had left them in my coat pocket. My purse was locked in your car. Your father's car you only once let me smoke in, never again, in a basement in the belly of the city. After the play, I wanted to roam and play Audrey Hepburn Roman Holiday and walk amongst monuments wearing a cinch waist and a sunny smile on the arm of one well-dressed gentleman. But I didn't go to Cotillion and my feet hurt. So I made you hold my heels while I lit a smoke I had maneuvered back, likely by way of lipstick and not rhetoric. I had no qualms about being barefoot, even in the cold, even in the concrete, dirty city. I could see your toes cringe in your wingtips. You paid for lunch, but you didn't pay me a single compliment. You knew they'd only go to my head. This poem is about the dreamiest boy in high school and what happened when he became not the dreamiest boy in high school. So. It's called PMS Revealed. When I was 15 and crammed in the cafeteria, warm with bodies and noise, the dreamiest boy in school, an angelic choir boy, lately turned well-behaved rock star, but probably once a devoted altar boy, all glory to God, told me, girls don't get horny. He said girls didn't have enough hormones for that. I laughed. And he didn't. I prodded. No, really, you think? He said it was simple science. As I stood up and dumped his suit down his front, I thought, poor Steve. Girls have more hormones than you'd ever even begin to know what to do with. Somehow that year I gained a reputation for being too much. How are we doing on time, Jocelyn?
We got 5 minutes.
Oh, okay. Any town, Indiana. He's slamming dope and I'm sleeping around. There must be a heavy star hanging above us, only shining dark light and fixing to drop any minute. Now rumors float through town that there's something wrong between us. Small town's funny. Can only hold so many facts but fit a mess of lies. Rumors like smoke gets everywhere, and soon it's gonna be true. Nothing we can do. Okay, I'm gonna do two more. The first one is actually the poem that is featured in the zine that is for sale. So I hope you like it, so you buy it. It's called 47374, which is the zip code for Richmond, Indiana, which is where I went to college. Right? This town is desolate and gray, empty save for those still waiting to leave, and washed out in either lonely morning or solemn evening half-light, sapping saturation from the already sun-bleached land and cityscape. This town is faded billboards. The earth here is flat and endless, and the clouds are still and low. This open Midwestern air with room for greeting, time for vowels, is what taught me to be friendly to strangers and allowed me to grow cold. 2. This is the most beautiful place, but maybe I speak only from attachment, because leaving it would be uprooting one tree. Leafless and sparse, exposed to the winter months, defenseless. One field tree, misplaced in the corn, all the nutrients still in the ground. The shock of travel could kill me. There is no hope for transplant now. I'm rooted to right outside this town. I've worked my way into the soil, dropped all my leaves, and faded my way into black and gray. And this last poem is my, you know, poem dedicated to the wonders of modern medicine. Monday's pills. Take Monday's pills on Monday. The morning pills in the morning, the evening pills at night. In the morning, take some extra. Your feet will ache eventually, or your head, or knees. Recite for us the litany. Aripiprazole, citalopram, clonazepam, esomeprazole magnesium, fexofenadine hydrochloride, norethindrone acetate, and ethanol estradiol, ranitidine. Like saints, because without them you are always wailing, screaming without reason, snotty, sneezy, and sad. You are sick to your stomach and flowing with bile. Your disability. But a pretty one. Monday's pills are sunset orange and Easter chick yellow, nail polish purple and eyeshadow blue, all shades of brown and peach, colors from a compact or from a cartoon.
So that was Allergic to Cats, folks. Thanks so much for coming. You've been so warm, so welcoming. Don't forget, we've got a silent auction going on over here. We've got zines for sale, and it would make me very happy if you would sign our sign-up sheet so I can send you emails and Facebook invites about our future events.